welcome to another episode of What Matters in North Carolina. As always, I am your host, Matt Calder, and we have a packed show for you today that also is a little bit outside of our normal topics of things that really relate directly to the state or are only really based in the state, but we will get back to that. First, I want to talk about subscribing to the podcast, because subscribing to the podcast is the easiest way for you to keep up with what's going on with What Matters in North Carolina. It requires no going out and searching for the episodes. They will just show up on your phone or your tablet, your computer, wherever you listen to podcasts. They will show up on that automatically throughout the week. To do that, all you have to do is go where you listen to podcasts. And search What Matters in North Carolina. Just the name of the show, What Matters in North Carolina, and you can subscribe and take a lot of that effort out of your day of coming and searching out the show. If you're not already following along with us on social media, you want to make sure you're doing that too on Facebook and Twitter at What Matters NC. That is at What Matters NC on Facebook and Twitter. Though again, when you're subscribing, you search for the whole name, What Matters in North Carolina. Now, if you do want to check out older episodes of the show or the other shows on the Freedom Action Network, like the Frida Brew Show or the NC Gun Dad Show, all you have to do is go to freedomactionnetwork.com and you can go find those episodes there. Again, that is freedomactionnetwork.com. Now, moving on to today's topic, we have a couple of segments today, the first of which being about Charlottesville. Of course, everyone knows about the white supremacist protest that was then counter-protested by a lot of other different groups from the left. It ended in violence and ended in the death of a counter-protester when a white supremacist rammed his car into a group of counter-protesters, killing one, and also the death of two police officers who were in a helicopter that was doing surveillance of the area that ended up crashing on a golf course. And I'm sure there's more information there, but directly ended in the death of this one woman who was with the counter-protesters. Anyway, so on today's show, Demi and I, Demi Dowdy, of course, who's been on the show a number of times, are going to be talking about what happened in Charlottesville a little bit, but more about issues surrounding Charlottesville after everything happened. We're going to be talking about some of the issues going on, some of the reasons that it seems like there's so much animosity in a lot of places, and you'll just have to listen to that segment to see what's going on there. Then after that, Demi and Dr. Bob Libke, so again, Demi Dowdy and Dr. Bob Libke, who's also been on the show before, are going to talk about the state budget through the lens of education, as everything really to Bob does. That's really where his focus lies, and while he is the executive vice president of the Civitas Institute now, he still has a heavy focus on education, and we will hear from him about that. So without further ado, we'll move right into the segment between Demi Dowdy and I now. So joining us now, we have Demi Dowdy coming on for an extended media meltdown segment this week, where we're going to talk about what happened in Charlottesville and more really what happened after Charlottesville and is still happening in North Carolina and across the nation. And I mean, so that's why we've got you here today. So thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me again.
So I guess I'll give a quick rundown of everyone who is coming out from underneath the rock they've been under for this entire week. There was a protest in Charlottesville, Virginia, of the planned decision to take down a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee.
Right.
And this was a protest that was a conglomerate of neo-Nazi groups, white supremacy, white nationalist groups, mm-hmm. not very nice people. About 500 or so showing up to protest, taking down the statue. Anti-protesters or counter-protesters, the Antifa, the anti-fascists, mm-hmm. the Black Lives Matter, these mm-hmm. groups show up as well.
With mace and urine-filled balloons.
And all sorts of unhappy things.
Yes,
and about 1,000 or so, about twice as much as the original mm-hmm. protesters. Filling up the small, Charlottesville, Virginia, sleepy college town during the summer, pretty sleepy town. Mm-hmm. And there's violence that breaks out between them. And police come back, step back in, split them up, throw them out of the park. And
in a site near the park where a march was getting planned or put together by the counter protesters. A white supremacist takes his car and just rams into them, killing a woman.
Yeah.
And now we are in the fallout stage of this, where there's vigils, other protests here in North Carolina and across the country.
Right.
So that's kind of the stage. So where do we go from here now?
Sure. So, you know, obviously the media have lost their minds and can seem to only focus on one hate group who was present that day. And I fully understand that this group of white supremacists, white nationalists, neo-Nazis, were the original protesters on the site, right? And they are, by definition, in my opinion, evil, despicable. They are a hate group. But unfortunately for the media and their narrative, hate speech is protected under the First Amendment, just as it is protected when it comes from Black Lives Matter or when it comes from Antifa. What is not protected by the First Amendment is violence that happens as a result.
And exactly. That is kind of a core point that you want to, I guess, bring up. And
yes.
So you had these protests, and let's say, rewind the clock, the protesters, they have their permit, and we can talk about all the issues surrounding the permitting process, the police response, all that stuff is another conversation. Sure. But so these neo-Nazis and company have their protests where they're espousing these ideas that I would have thought we put to bed back in the 40s.
Yeah.
But this is, you know, they're peacefully espousing their craziness.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine.
Right.
The counter-protesters show up and are protesting their point, and they are espousing their viewpoints. That's fine. If everyone stayed peaceful, they can yell at each other if they want to, but if there had been no action, no throwing of things, no mace, no fisticuffs, no violence, person to person.
Mm-hmm.
If they had done that, they would be within their First Amendment rights. But when violence broke out, I mean, and it became an unlawful protest. At that point, it was said to be, and they pushed people out of the park where they were at, Emancipation Park in Charlottesville. So that's when things turned.
It is. And you know, you can talk all day long about, you know, hypothesize all day long about who started the violence, and neither you or I were there, right? So we don't know, and there are obviously conflicting reports. But there is one fact here, and that is that a woman was killed. And the woman was not killed by Antifa or Black Lives Matter that day, but a woman was killed by a neo-Nazi who ran through a crowd with his car. And so I think that makes it very easy to blame all of the violence that day on just one side, right? And I think that we need to be a little bit more logical and look at how things escalated. And things did not escalate just because of violence on one side.
Right. And see, that point, though, is so lost outside of this building. And it's lost in the media. It's lost in the political sphere, that let's look at the problems on both sides. I mean, this is what President Trump was condemned for saying.
And he's saying, and it won't go away.
Oh, I know. And whatever he said wasn't going to go well for the people who are opposed against Trump, vehemently against him. But judging on what he said from the outside, he's saying violence on all sides of this situation is wrong. And there is, you know, video evidence of violence from both sides.
Mm-hmm.
So this would be extremism on both sides.
Right.
And this is the whole point is, you know, you're saying it's wrong. President Trump said it's wrong. I'm saying it's wrong on both sides. But if you're not only saying it against the white supremacists, you're labeled as a sympathizer. You're labeled as someone on that side, which not be further from the truth.
Right. So unfortunately, to your point, the being logical and looking at all of the facts apparently makes you a racist. And that's why up until now, I really haven't verbalized this, especially not on social media, on my personal social media, because it's not worth being called a racist, and it's for most people, and it's not worth being attacked. So it's unfortunate that we can't talk about ideology without being labeled a racist. And not only can we not talk about ideology, but we can't debate facts of a very real set of circumstances that happened in Charlottesville without, as you said, being labeled a sympathizer and being labeled a neo-Nazi. And it's very unfortunate, because if we can't actually boil down to the facts, then we can't actually solve the problem that resulted in violence, right? And if we can't debate ideology, we can't debate the facts respectfully without it being so charged, then we will never actually solve the issues at hand.
Oh, exactly. I mean, if you can't have the conversation, you can't move the needle anywhere. You can't go anywhere from it. And this, so you and I would say, are in the middle of this situation, very, very obviously. I mean, there's the Black Lives Matter Antifa mm-hmm. on this one side, and on the far side, other way, mm-hmm. there's the neo-Nazis, the white nationalists, white supremacists. And we're not in either one of those camps. Sure. Like I said, I'm the guy standing in the middle saying sure. You're both stupid. Like, I'm the guy standing in the middle going...
And I would say evil. I mean, to be honest, I would say both are evil. But again, evil speech and hate speech is still protected by the First Amendment. And it doesn't mean also that you're violent.
Oh, yeah. And I'm saying, so we're here saying, I'm not with you, I'm not with you. Mm-hmm. And that's not... The narrative does not want that. What's being put out on the media and social media and the political figures who are pushing this do not want there to be a middle ground. They want there to be this division. It seems that there has to be this desire for there to be a division in these sides. And that doesn't help anybody.
Right. No, it absolutely does not. And it's unfortunate because, as I said, we can't talk about ideology without being labeled a racist. But then the left has seemed to take it a step further. And this is something that I've written an article about on nccivitas.org. Not only are you labeled a racist, but you're publicly shamed now. And there are certain individuals who have become or take it upon themselves to become the thought police and say that if you disagree with them or if you say anything to the contrary of we should destroy every neo-Nazi and white supremacist and they are the only hate group that is violent, then you should be destroyed, your livelihood should be destroyed, and you should be publicly shamed.
Exactly. I mean, and you and I sitting here having this recording, you're having this conversation, this, what I believe is logical talk, talking about there's problems that you're going on, there's definitely problems with the neo-Nazis, there's been problems on the other side, having this very normal conversation is seen by many as extreme.
It is.
Because I'm not sitting here only yelling and talking about how wrong neo-Nazis are. Mm-hmm. For the record, neo-Nazis, awful. White supremacists, awful. White nationalists, awful.
Right.
And because I don't stop there, I'm opposed, because I also say that extremism on the other side is a problem, because you're saying extremism on both sides is a problem. Mm-hmm. Suddenly we are on a certain side. That is so illogical to condemn everything on the extreme, all the extremism involved in the situation.
Right.
Puts you on a side.
Right. Well, and it doesn't just put you on a side. They label you as dangerous, Matt. And I think that labeling and that mob mentality of going after anyone who does disagree with you or does look at all sides and tries to insert logic into this debate, I think that is dangerous. And I think it's also a very slippery slope. And so now you have people like Logan Smith from Progress NC, who's being hailed all over the country right now by CNN and by The Hill and by NBC. And he's being interviewed on national news outlets talking about what a noble thing it is that he has summoned a mob on Twitter via his Twitter account that he created. Yes, I'm racist. He is a hero, and he's labeled a hero for outing people via photos from the crowds in Charlottesville, via photos from Trump rallies, and via their own Twitter feeds and words that they use that he deems as racist. suddenly we are in a very, very dangerous slippery slope that people are being outed and they are actually losing their jobs as a result. People are calling for them to be fired and asking their employer to fire them. Lena Dunham recently did this when she said that there were airline employees that she overheard saying very transphobic things, again, according to her, and asked for them to be fired. And Jennifer Lawrence has jumped on the bandwagon on Twitter, too, outing racists on Twitter, again, by her own definition, and asking for them to be fired and their livelihoods to be destroyed. This is scary.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people are being put into a box that is being defined by others. I mean, this is a huge issue, I think, that people of us, if you're not in the popular thought process, the popular ideology, if you're not, or even you even could be, but if you're not willing to condemn offhand just based on someone else's words. So someone comes to me and says, here's a situation. If I'm not willing to immediately call that person out, if I go, well, let me just find out more information. And I'm not referring to Charlottesville. I mean, looking at what groups showed up to that protest, it's very obvious who was there in the protest. I'm not even talking about the counter-protesters. I'm talking about just other situations.
Sure.
Where you're expected to just offhand immediately say the opinion, whatever the opinion is. And if you don't, you're labeled as sympathetic to it, part of it.
Right.
It is a very slippery slope where you end up with one thought, and if you're not part of that one thought, you're on the wrong side of history, the wrong side of the issue. And that's not what America's built on.
Right.
It's built on other bunch of ideas coming together and working out what's going to happen, working out how things are going to go.
Yeah, you join the mob and the thought mentality of the mob, or you're vilified. And that's what's so dangerous and scary. And that same mob is, you know, now they're taking very violent action. They're taking action like taking down monuments without any official process to decide whether that should or should not happen. They're taking the law into their own hands and actions into their own hands. And they're doing some really crazy things now. And it's really scary.
Oh, it is. And what I think about, so Governor Roy Cooper put out his statement about monuments and how they should be brought down. And it's a very interesting how he separates between how the protesters can get hurt, how it's dangerous and all this stuff. It's very, and it take me a second to find it, but basically he's talking about how it's dangerous for the protesters because they could hurt themselves taking down these monuments. So here we go. My first responsibility as governor is to protect North Carolinians and keep them safe.
Right.
I agree with that idea. The likelihood of protesters being injured or worse as they may try to topple any one of the hundreds of monuments in our state concerns me, and the potential for the same white supremacist elements we saw in Charlottesville to swarm the site, weapons in hand, in retaliation, is a threat to public safety. So it's going, the protesters could hurt themselves taking down these monuments, and then you have these other people, which white supremacist elements seems to include more. When you look at Governor Cooper's statement, it is two sides. It is only saying there. It seems to say there's only saying there's two sides.
Right. And there's certainly not any reasonable people in between who want to debate it on its merit.
Right. And that's the kind of language I just so disagree with. That we're not seeing the ability for people to not be in a side in conversation from a lot of people who are in power or have a lot of influence. There's this. Protesting this the word escapes me right now, but this resistance to letting people not be on a side or on a far side.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the other thing too is that there's no doubt in my mind that this is politicizing by Roy Cooper of the issue of the day. And this is not something he ever discussed before, okay? He suddenly has an opinion on something that he never before had an opinion on. And he decided to do an op-ed. He tweeted the other day, the night actually that happened in Durham, that the monument was ripped down. And somehow before that, he never had an opinion on this. And I don't think that does anything but divide. And exactly to your point that you were making as well. It does nothing but divide. And that's really unfortunate to have in a governor.
Right. And his statement really, it puts in a box any opinion about Confederate monuments that is not, they all need to be torn down. It really puts people in a box in that. It creates the two groups of, you're either a protester trying to tear them down and you might get hurt, or you're a white supremacist who wants to swarm the site, weapons in hand.
Right.
And that's just not true. There are ways to have arguments about, well, what are the different monuments? Mm-hmm. Is there a deference to something that's been up for 200 years or, you know, 150 years versus mm-hmm. something that was put up 10 years ago, 20 years ago?
Sure.
You're talking, and it's a nuanced issue.
That's right.
We were talking before the interview about, is there a difference between a statue of Robert E. Lee and a monument to the foot soldiers who died in the war, who weren't fighting necessarily for slavery, or maybe they're fighting for their home or the different motivations. Is there a difference between an obelisk to hundreds of unknown Confederate soldiers who were Americans versus one leader of the Confederacy?
Yes, there is a difference, right? And there's an argument to be made that there's a difference between honoring the leader of the Confederacy, which could be appalling to some, and honoring the deaths of everyone who fought in that war, who were all Americans.
Right. And not even talking about where you land on that conversation, just the ability to have that conversation is being taken away time and time again on so many fronts, it seems like. It seems like if you want to have the conversation, you're put into a side.
Right.
And that is not good for anyone. Not being able to have a conversation about a topic without it being so politically charged that just by having the conversation, your stance is identified for you, is a really bad road.
It is. And I think as we've gone down that road, it's become abundantly clear that the left has no interest in civil discourse. They have no interest in having a nuanced debate about the things you're talking about or anything else. They're only interested in silencing the other side. And that's the bottom line. And we discussed also earlier, that's why the conversation about racism, which certainly does exist still in our country, unfortunately, that conversation is so charged because the left does want to immediately silence any difference of opinion as being racist.
And that's a bad road in its own right. I mean, I agree. Racism still exists in this country. And I think in a lot of ways, it is either getting worse or more in the forefront. I think about from when I was growing up versus now with my young daughter looking at the world she's going to grow up in, I feel worse about the world that she's looking at, honestly.
Sure.
And there's a statement in Cooper's release that could get him in trouble. And with the people I don't want to say pandering to, but with
sure.
the people who are against amendments, he says, second, I've asked the Department of Natural and Cultural Resources to determine the cost and logistics of removing Confederate monuments from state property, as well as alternatives for their placement at museums or historical sites where they can be studied in context.
Right.
So he is opening the door there for preserving these monuments.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many who are calling for the destruction and tearing down these monuments who could jump on that and jump on Governor Cooper for saying this, saying he is sympathizing sympathizing with this cause they're against. When, if you're looking at it, and a lot of these historical markers are already at historically significant sites to the Confederate battles, Union battles, the Civil War, but they could jump on this statement.
Yeah, I think you're going to see a lot more fallout from this. And unfortunately, as you pointed out earlier, Governor Cooper does not seem to care about the opinions of all North Carolinians. He has been firmly planted on one side of this issue and made that very public now. And it sounds like he's going to take action.
Yeah, and it does seem that way. And he's got some legal hurdles to taking action there's been a law passed about removing Confederate memorials that was passed a couple of years ago. It's a hurdle. So there's limited things that could be done by Cooper to actually carry out taking down these monuments. So we'll see where that sort of goes.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think that this is one of those, if you're not 100% in lockstep with the narrative, then you're 100% against it. And that is never a good idea. That never goes to a good place throughout history, in my mind, that not being able to have even a conversation about whether or not you have differing opinions, not even final product opinion, not even action, final product action, just shutting down the conversation about it. Like, I fully believe I could go talk to somebody and they would just maybe think I might have a different opinion, and we might have the exact same opinion, but we can't even get to that point.
Right.
And that's not a good place to be for anyone.
No, it's not. And you're right. I think that the thought police and unfortunately the left who is very powerful right now, and in North Carolina, that is Governor Cooper. They just want to silence. And that is the most dangerous part of the fallout, I think, from Charlottesville, is that we've already seen that happening. And we've seen it already be a slippery slope in this country. But I think it's going to continue to devolve until they get what they want. And that is that any dissenting opinion is silenced for good.
Right. And what this sort of reminds me of is the Dylann Roof shooting in Charleston. And you remember that one?
I do,
they went
yeah.
into the church. And so after this, there was that shooting, there was that image that came up with the Confederate flag. And the Confederate flag was vilified to the point that Dukes of Hazzard was taken off the air.
Right.
A show that I grew up loving watching, Bo and Luke Duke. So, and it was very successful. I mean, if you think about where have you seen the Confederate flag versus now, and it seems like this is a round two, it seems like coming out. But it seems that no one really learned anything from the way it went around before, because there was a lot of contention, there was a lot of anger on multiple sides coming out of that, and I feel like we're repeating that situation. We're right back there.
I think you're right, and again, they're just not going to stop until it ends the way they want it to end.
And what you said earlier, I want to go back to the slippery slope.
Mm-hmm.
If you remove the Confederate monuments from, you know, state property or from public property,
right,
but then put it in museums, what's next? What's the next thing that's going to be gone after? What is the next thing?
Yeah, if you take it to its logical end, then you're going to see these things removed. Anything that the left deems necessary to remove from history could be removed from museums. And that's what they'll do next. And then they'll remove it from history books. I mean, we've already seen an editing of history from the left. And unfortunately, it's infiltrated our public schools. And it's infiltrated our state colleges. So that is the problem. Absolutely. That if you take this to its logical end, it doesn't stop here. If you take them to their logical end, conservatives take them to their logical end, and you say it from the get-go, then you're called crazy, right? But that is where they want it to go.
Well, I think about, so we have a problem with neo-Nazis now. And if we go back, when do we start editing the history books and removing the Holocaust from being taught and learned about? When do they shut down the memorial at Auschwitz? When do they start removing those things to the point that people aren't learning about these mistakes that the human race made in history?
Mm-hmm.
When do we not learn about the Trail of Tears and not learn about how the Native Americans were taught or were treated? When do we stop teaching these things? And after that, you know, when do you repeat these things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Unless it fits the left narrative, then it will not exist in the future.
I mean, there's the quote, those who do not learn history are doomed to repeat it. And there's quote, you know, questions about who that quote came from. But it is a good quote and a lasting quote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so I think that's where we'll leave it. So thank you for coming on. And
thanks, Matt.
And going over all this with us.
Thanks.
If you like this show and want to hear a segment again or want to check out one of our past shows, head over to freedomactionnetwork.com. Or check out some of the other shows the Freedom Action Network has to offer, like Free to Brew, where host Greg Polcher uncovers how freeing up markets, protecting property rights, and an entrepreneur spirit has rejuvenated the craft beer industry. Listen to the show for interviews and commentary from brewers, policy experts, and more. Let Greg show you there is liberty in beer. Or check out the NC Gun Dad Show, hosted by me, Matt Calder, where I talk about guns, gun rights, and Second Amendment issues of the day. Also, where we explore how being a father informs being a responsible gun owner, and more. Again, that can all be found on the Freedom Action Network website at www.freedomactionnetwork.com. Now, we are talking with Demi Dowdy and Dr. Bob Libke on the show, and they are going to actually kind of take the reins on this segment and have their own little conversation about the state budget and specifically relating to education. Right, Demi?
That's right, Matt. So I am here with Dr. Bob Libke, and he is our education policy analyst here at the Civitas Institute. I run communications here at Civitas, and we're going to just have a quick chat about the budget. So, Bob, the state budget is a grand total of $23 billion, an enormous number. But what's in the budget is not just about that dollar amount. It's not just about the numbers. There are some significant policy issues that also might signal how what future budgets will look like, what the legislature may be doing down the road. So talk to us about that.
That's right, Demi. I know whenever newspapers and the media talk about the state budget, all of our eyes just glaze over it because
sure.
It's numbers, 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 and after a while they all lose meaning. It's true that state budget is primarily about numbers, but it also can include a lot of important policy directional changes, as well as include signals, you know, that how the legislature may act in the future on different issues. So that's really important. And this past budget, you know, was no exception. And if you actually are a wonk like a lot of us here and actually, you know, comb through these, you know, 200-page documents
right.
On the budget, you can actually find some of those things that are important and significant to all of us. And that's kind of what I wanted to talk about today. Basically, just three issues impacting education and, you know, what relevance it has for all of us today.
Right. So what are some of those issues? So there are a few areas, a few things identified in the state budget that are some signals to what we may see down the road. What are those?
That's right, Demi. We're going to talk about three of those today. The first one we want to talk about is some of the changes that the legislature made to the state lottery.
Right.
Now, people know that every year the legislature makes changes to the state lottery.
Mm-hmm.
And more often than not, that involves tweaking the percentages of how much money is going to go to what area.
Right.
Like pre-K scholarships, school building facilities, you know, things like that.
Right.
But this year, they actually included a number of larger changes with regards to how the educational lottery monies are going to be divided, and those major changes were twofold. Basically, the first was to actually increase the amount of money that is going to say the category. Let me back up. They previously did not have a category of what's called transportation.
Okay.
When you say
school buses?
School buses, you know, paying for school, bus drivers, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And this year and next year, this year actually, 2017, 2018, legislature allotted about $43 million, which is a lot of money,
mm-hmm.
to school districts to help pay for transportation costs. That previously was not in there.
Okay. Interesting.
Also, the legislature also increased the amount of money that went to what are called non-instructional support personnel.
Okay.
Who are those people? We're talking about teacher's assistants, say technology, service people, people involved in transportation, school family advocates, things like that. People mm-hmm. not involved directly in the instruction of your children, but people that assist
right.
in that function. Now, why is that important? This year, that the amount of money spent on non-instructional support personnel increased to about $380 million from about $330 million. That's almost 60% of all the money that the state provides schools for, that the state provides in lottery revenue. That's a lot of money. Now, the other categories that the state funds with lottery money are scholarships for UNC pre-K programs.
Mm-hmm.
They also provide student financial aid. And as I said before, money, approximately $100 million for school building, what's called school capital building funds, which okay. is basically money that is distributed to local schools to help defray the costs of
infrastructure,
building new schools, et cetera.
Right.
Now, the other major change to that is that program has been in existence, but what they did now is basically say the state superintendent can distribute monies to local school districts but via a formula where LEA would be one of either two categories. I don't want to get into all the complications of it, but it's basically they can get up to either $15 million or $30 million.
$10
million or $30 million based on the need for the school and actually basically the tax base of the LEA. So that's significant. Why is that significant? It not only shows that, first of all, that the majority of the money is not really going into
right.
the classroom, but also it's a recognition that the way we fund new schools in North Carolina is really broken.
Interesting.
And I think this kind of buys the legislature a little bit of time. So that's, you know, that's kind of significant because I think a number of larger changes are coming down the road as far as how North Carolina funds schools.
Interesting. I know that you've talked a lot also about a creation of a commission on education finance reform. So this is yet another education issue. So what is that
yes,
going to look like?
This actually ties a little bit into the topic I just talked about.
Right,
but
right.
this has kind of been on the back burner for almost a decade.
Hmm.
10 years ago, North Carolina had commission that was on the study that studied, you know, the existing school finance formulas. I think there are about 30 some odd formulas that drive revenue to local districts. And they hired an independent consultant. He filed a report. The actual report was actually pretty well received by people on both sides of the aisle. But what happened then was the recession. And the report got put on a shelf.
That makes sense.
And nothing happened for a decade.
Wow.
Now we're back to the same problem. And actually, 10 years later, one of the major differences is that Republicans and many conservatives, you know, have positions of leadership here. And it's our opportunity to kind of stamp and bring significant changes to education finance. Now,
right.
one of those changes, which has actually been in some of the legislation, is that there is a great sentiment to have funds follow the student.
Mm-hmm.
You'll be hearing a lot about what's called weighted student formulas, which is a way of actually doing that, where funds are provided to children based on needs, you know, whether they have a disability,
uh-huh.
Possibly income, what type of background they come from, educational ability, things like that, where an actual formula will allot funding to individual children based on that. And then the funding will follow the child wherever the child goes. That's a significant change.
Yeah.
Currently, we distribute money based on what are called allotments and 33
okay.
different formulas, et cetera. But there seems to be a lot of sentiment that way. The budget included legislation to create a commission on education finance reform that will study this topic.
Okay.
And that should be beginning shortly in the next couple of months. And usually what commissions do is they study the topic and provide the outlines of possible legislation. So that will be significant. Also to be noted, and this is free. We don't charge it all. This is free advice. We also are a free prediction here. We'll note that nothing major will happen next year because right. It is an election year.
That's an excellent point, Bob.
So they'll study it, and any legislation, any significant moves legislatively, and this believe me, it'll be a heavy lift because mm-hmm. we're talking about state appropriations for. Public schools are about $9.5 billion. It's the largest single component of the state budget.
Right.
So there'll be a lot of serious discussion on this, but not likely to happen until probably January of 19.
Yes.
At the earliest.
That makes sense. So I noticed that also there will be some full-time staff added for the UNC Board of Governors. Tell us about that.
Well, there may be. That's the key word. There may be. That's actually what the statute says.
Okay.
They may add.
Okay.
If they want.
They just want the option.
Well, that's what is actually in the statute, the actual legislation. They have the prerogative to do so. This is an interesting issue because anybody who looks at institutional governance will realize that one of the things that controls or influences the agenda is the flow of information.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to, you know, govern wisely, you have to have adequate support staff, et cetera. And if you look at the way the Board of Governors is set up, the Board of Governors really doesn't have any.
Interesting.
If there are any questions, et cetera, all the information, all the analysis, all the studies, anything, information requests, goes through the UNC system.
Hmm.
Now, let me say that I often don't argue for adding staff.
Right.
Especially to, you know, permanent bureaucracies.
Yes.
Why this is an exception is because the way that current system is set up, it is not a level playing field.
Okay.
And how do I say this simply without getting into a lot of detail? I said previously that if a member of the Board of Governors has questions, they put those questions to the UNC General Administration staff,
mm-hmm.
many of which are good people, etc.
Okay.
But the important point here is those staff report to the president of the university, not to the UNC Board of Governors.
Interesting.
Which is an important point.
Right.
Now, regarding loyalty, et cetera. Now, it also means that you might not be getting the most objective information in the most objective analysis on, you know, requests that, you know, are put through.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not saying that's happening, but what we do say is that the current structure leaves a potential for that to happen because there's not institutional balance.
Right.
We believe that that information should, you know, not come from, you know, a source that the individuals are responsible to someone other than, you know, the boss of the Board of Governors. So that provision, the actual provision that got put in the budget, said that the UNC system may hire additional staff.
Okay.
And
they might.
Now, I think why that was put in there is because there was some sentiment amongst Board of Governors that some people said, well, we don't believe that we need that. And I think they put that in there not as pretty much as a hammer, but a suggestion if they
sure.
do, ch- do do
seems
choose
a little
to
non-committal,
do that.
But we'll
it's non-committal,
but
it provides the option.
That's
to,
right.
If they want to move forward, and as I said before, I think we'd be in favor of this because it balances
gives some balance.
It balances the playing field involved. You know?
Okay, that's so helpful. Thanks, Bob. So another thing that's mentioned in there is something that we are very excited about at Civitas, something we've advocated for years. What's that?
Yes, and the last thing I wanted to bring up is what are called personal education savings accounts, which anybody who's listened to this program will know that I have harped incessantly on what are called ESAs. And North Carolina's ESA is basically what's called a PESA. Education savings accounts are really the future of school choice.
That's right.
And anyone who's followed the state budget will know that the legislators passed a small ESA program for special needs students, also for other populations, which include dependents of active military personnel,
mm-hmm.
Adopted children, and foster kids. And that program will be ramping up. They'll do a lot of necessary administrative plotting in the next year, but it will not go into effect until fall of 18.
Okay.
We just can't, there's not enough time to do it actually for this fall, but it'll be a year from this fall where the actual people will begin to actually be recipients of the money involved. What are we talking specifics? Eligible students will be able to get funding up to $9,000 if they apply. If they apply and receive the funding,
That means
that parents will have access to an account where they can spend up to $9,000 on appropriate educational expenditures for their child to ensure that they're getting the best possible education.
That's great. That's so exciting, and hopefully that continues to expand.
Yes, that's we believe if we follow what's been going on in other states, it will expand because those programs have proved immensely popular.
That's excellent. Well, Bob, thanks for hitting on some of these things in the budget and identifying some of the issues in there as well as the numbers. And I'm sure we'll be talking more about this in the future.
Thank you, Demi.
All right. Thank you, Demi and Bob, for taking the time to take us through a few different bullet points in the budget relating to education. Thank you to Demi as well for her first segment between me and her about the situation in Charlottesville and a lot of the issues surrounding that situation. But also thank you to you, the listeners. Thank you for tuning in to this show, whether you're listening down in Wilmington on Sunday night or whether you're listening to it throughout the week on your computer or your tablet. Thank you for taking the time to sit down with us and spend a little time hearing about what matters in North Carolina. Again, if you're not already subscribed to the podcast, make sure you're doing that by going and searching What Matters in North Carolina wherever you listen to podcasts. Make sure you're following along with social media by searching at What Matters NC if you are not already following along on Facebook and Twitter. And if you are following along with us, or if you're going to be newly following along with us, engage with us. Tell us what you think of the show. Tell us what you want to hear about on the show. Tell us what you think about the issues we discuss on the show. Make sure you're talking with us and engaging and making this into a better show than it can be or than it already is. Also, if you want to hear more episodes of this show or more shows like it or more shows on the Freedom Action Network, just go to freedomactionnetwork.com. And you can listen to the past episodes of this show, or the Free to Brew show, or the NC Gun Dad show, and just check out what other content we have available. So remember, subscribe, like, follow, engage, and check out what you missed on the network. Check out the shows that you haven't heard, and make sure you are up to date on what matters in North Carolina. You are up to date on everything that matters in North Carolina. And we'll catch you next time.